Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki. I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Robin Pimentel, who's an international engineer, technology executive, entrepreneur, and investor. Now, Robin, you just have an amazing and very long success history and so many outstanding global contributions. Thank you for sharing your experiences, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
It's my pleasure to be here with you, Stephen. Thank you for having me.
Now, Robin, you are a venture and general partner with K5. What is a venture partner, and what tips can you share about this work for people wanting to launch a startup?
Sure. So I agree that it's important to know who you're communicating with as a founder inside of a venture firm. And the roles inside of a firm can vary. What I would say is, in general, a venture partner is responsible for interfacing with startups. They're usually very active in their respective ecosystems. So, you know, if they're big in robotics, they'll be active in the robotic startup scene. If they're very active if there's a particular geography that is in play, you know, if there's Silicon Beach or what have you, they'll typically be active in that ecosystem as well. And they can be a startup's internal advocate, you know, within a fund. It's think of them as someone who invests time into the fund. And in the case of K5, the venture partner not only invests time, but also invests their money into the fund.
So how long have you been a venture and general partner with K5?
I started with K5 in late 2012. So it's coming up on 3 years now.
Now, you have such an eclectic background, but you're also a member of the UCLA Venture Capital Fund. Can you describe your work and useful lessons from your experiences with the fund?
Absolutely. The UCLA Venture Fund is something that, in terms of the management of it, I'm less active. So I'm what you would call more akin to what somebody would call in a traditional fund, a limited partner. So this would just be someone who invests and doesn't really get too involved, but being active in K5 and as an individual investor, I do tend to keep tabs on some of the startups there and just see if there are ways that that I can help and engage them. But UCLA is a nonprofit, so it's a nonprofit fund. So they just use a different nomenclature. So instead of being called a limited partner, I'm called a member, and that's kind of the way that you know, they've designated their roles.
So in your view, what are the grow evolution stages for a startup and criteria for success in each stage?
Sure. So, there's going to be a lot here. I think it's really important, and it's a lot to take in, but I think it is important to understand as a startup where you are in your evolution, what stage you're in. And so much of it really depends on the founders themselves. So, you know, if they have an existing network of investors or if they're new entrepreneurs, that can change how you progress through the steps of your startup. The geography that you're in can also have an effect. So, you know, but having said that, I think there is a way to frame in a relative way what stage any given startup might be in. I would say that in the beginning, you're kind of maybe have an idea. Maybe you have a product in mind. I call that the genesis phase. You may have some co-founders that get excited alongside with you, and they decide to jump in, which is, you know, great validation to have as a founder. Then comes the bootstrap stage, and you know, that can give you a lot of detail about what that stage means. But it basically means that you've got some rudimentary prototypes that you're building, and you're testing traction. You're employing some experiments and validating some of your assumptions. After that, you may get some first money. And I won't go into the whole friends and family versus angel debate, but, you know, we can if that's interesting as well. But here, typically, you get your first money, and you start building your MVP. And the MVP, you know, the V is crucial in the MVP, and we can talk about that, too, if you like. But I will say that one thing to keep in mind is that an MVP for an electric car is going to be a lot more resource intensive than an MVP for, say, a Dropcam, including all of its, you know, cloud features, let's say. After that first money phase, I would say that depending on how the traction goes, at some point you may enter an accelerator or an incubator, a way to formalize the working environments, but also then begin to bring in some initial institutional money. So this is where folks that essentially invest in startups professionally and guide startups professionally may start to get involved. And you know, some startups get to skip this phase depending on the founders and their experience and whether they have a place to work and things like that. And we can talk about accelerators and incubators if you like. And then after that, typically you may raise a significant seed round. That's been the trend here in Orange County, is to go ahead and raise this kind of intermediate seed round. And a lot of people don't raise a seed round until they've gone through all these other stages that I've talked about in our ecosystem. But as I said, in different ecosystems, you get different results. And with different founders, you get different results. Some people just have a seed round and then an A round. That happens all the time. But in the case of a regular startup and one that you would typically find in Orange County, after that seed round, you would then significantly pick up your traction. You figure out everything that you need to scale your traction, whether that be revenue or users. And then you continue with your growth. You try to put it on a new trajectory and try to raise a Series A. So that's the early stage pipeline. Those are the stages that I work with the most. We have more than a few startups that are in their post-Series A, so Series B, Series C. And, you know, there are certain things that I think can be said about those, but it would probably be just as long of a response and, you know, maybe less useful to someone starting out.
Wow, you've given us some great ideas and sort of an overview, you know, sort of the stages, and we'll mine some of the things that you talked about later in this interview.
Sure.
Now, what are some lessons from startups that can be applied to small, medium-sized businesses or SMBs and enterprises to drive innovation and growth?
Right. Well, you know, I definitely believe that there are lessons that transcribe or that work across organizations and even across different value chains. I think one of the most probably compelling lessons, and it's a very open-ended question, but I think one of the things that jumps to mind is that one of the hardest things to do in small business and in startups is to disrupt yourself. But it can be done. There are, I think, methodologies to try and always continue to innovate, always continue to you know, figure out what the market is telling you. And then I think you can also probably think about customer or user experience. I really believe that when it comes to businesses, that user experience, product, the way that you consume what the business is offering is 80% of the equation, and maybe the consumption, and maybe the other 20% is basically good financial management. So I think good financial management is another component that is good and important for a small business and enterprise, an organization within a large enterprise, or a startup.
You know, you were talking about sort of the customer side, and I remember recently I was in Orange County and you were advising a startup. I happened to be there, and you were going through that user experience, and I was just amazed at how methodical you were. So you're just such a, you're brilliant in the area.
You're too kind, Stephen. Thank you.
Now, what are the triggers to higher levels of investment for startups?
Well, gosh, that is a good question. I think it's really it really goes along with some of those stages that we discussed. So maybe we can go back to some of those stages. I would say that having a prototype is a key enabler to being able to raise some of that first money. And I think having a co-founder, so it's very important that, you know, you try to bring someone on board who has equal stake, equal decision-making power, someone who is your equal and can challenge you to do better, and you can challenge each other and, you know, have your energy levels kind of, you know, bolster the resiliency of the enterprise. But I think having a co-founder is probably the first enabler to building a robust prototype and a robust product. And as I said, the prototype is good for that first money. After that, I think you want to be able to bootstrap yourself, and you should be working on a good experiment for your product. You should be reading the market really well. You should be spending a lot of time with users and iterating on product. And literally, that should be all that you do in the beginning. And once you have insights, once you've had discovery, once you feel that you've learned something from your consumers, customers, users, when you can answer the question, what do I know about them, then I think that should enable you to gain more traction and attract more of them. And the traction here, actually, at this stage may even be very disposable because it's so manual and everyone you're attracting is you're not doing it in an escapable manner. But I think once you feel that you have something where users are sticking to it, they're needing it, they're finding this value, this thing that they can't let go of, something that they have to pick up or use in their day-to-day, then I think you have an opportunity to polish it and build an MVP with a little bit more money and with a little bit of help from maybe professionals, and investment professionals, startup professionals. And I think then to be able to get that first seed round, it's going to take significant traction. So traction becomes then the thing that enables you to raise additional money. And it's very similar with the Series A as well. Series A, when you've got product market fit, as demonstrated not just by traction but by retention and by engagement and by you knowing your product and your consumers better than anyone else and knowing how to push the buttons that accelerate growth, when you've got a good engine with well-defined controls and well-defined readouts, then you may be able to actually have an airplane that will be functional, and that would be a trigger for a Series A.
You know, those are some great tips and trigger points that you've given to the audience. And I just should mention that when you mentioned MVP, those are minimum viable products.
Right. Oh, yes. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes. And I've heard a lot of people kind of say, what is the minimum valuable product? Because I think one of the most common things I see as an investor is that some founders just miss that V just slightly. You know, they miss out on that viability part, and they build something, but it's not actually creating value for their users. And so the trick is to do something very simple, but that single action creates value. And then a more complex product might have multiple actions that create multiple value chains.
Again, fascinating, especially with your background of working with so many startups and with these funds as well. Now, you know, there are some people out there who are thought leaders, Eric Ries, Steve Blank, Alexander Osterwalder, mm-hmm. Ben Horowitz, Peter Thiel, Clayton Christensen, and others. Do you have views on their work?
I do. I think there are they're all great reading. Some of their texts and blogs and maybe even talks do get very deep into the way that they see the world. But I think there are always some meaningful takeaways from all of the things that they discuss. I really enjoyed Ben Horowitz's approach to leadership, and in particular, and we can discuss some of the things that I've learned from him that I applied in some of my prior experiences. We can talk about that in a bit if you like. But I also really just stay on point. I really also enjoy Peter Thiel's book and the way that he describes innovation as from going from something that isn't there from something that is there, which I think is a very insightful way. He also describes kind of the gap between innovation in bits versus innovation in atoms, which I've always thought of as the virtual versus the real. And so, you know, we have a lot of startups now that are crossing over, and so much are the virtual and the real. So you've got, you know, Uber with the mobile app, but then somebody actually has to drive you around in the physical world. You've got Airbnb with the reservation system that is online and in the bits and software-driven and virtual, but then you actually stay at someone's house. So I'm such a big fan of that. And I'm also a big fan of innovation in just the pure atoms, which end up being enabled by software, actually. So if you look at Tesla, the company, it's great innovation in the atoms, in the physics, in battery storage, but so much is driven by the software, the fact that it doesn't let you charge the battery greater than 80% on a normal basis. The way that their algorithms help power the car is very software-driven, but I love that crossover between and the way to think about that as innovation in bits and atoms. I think it's just a wonderful way to frame how innovation is happening today with Peter Thiel's insight. I also enjoyed Clay Christensen and the Innovator's Dilemma, and he has such a body of research in addition to the book around disruption and around innovation, which I really enjoy. I'll say that his book is a little bit dated in the prose, but really insightful and relevant in its poetry. In other words, the concepts and the ideas are just as relevant today as they were when he wrote them. But a lot of the examples are hard to relate to nowadays. But if you've been, if you've been in the industry for a while, I think you can easily go back and think about what disk drives were like and feel right at home in the text.
Again, some great lessons and tips from your experiences and aligning with these thought leaders with regards to entrepreneurship and startups. You know, you talked about Tesla, and really they're a platform rather than just a car company.
Yeah, that's so true. It's such a, and again, when you feel what disruption feels like, these things often come across as platforms. They often come across as ways for other products to attach themselves, other experiences, other values, other value chains to be created just out of that technology, right? So you're absolutely right. It's a platform. It's a technology. So many things can be done with it.
You know, you talked about Peter Thiel, and I'm sort of curious, what are your thoughts of this fellowship program he has where he says, you know what, you're planning to go to college, but maybe you should try being an entrepreneur first.
I think it brings great relevance to education. I'll tell you that I accidentally took a similar road. I was recruited as a co-op by Intel in 1995, only after just 1 year at UCLA. And what was supposed to be a three-month co-op turned into a two-year experience with the on-chip memories division out in Chandler. I learned a lot, and I learned the limits of my understanding. I very quickly understood what I could not do and why I needed education, why I needed differential equations. It really gave me purpose and visibility into what education can do for me and what bits were really important to retain as I went through my undergraduate years.
Again, fascinating. Now, can you provide an overview of your experiences with some past startups and maybe share some useful experiences from each? For example, Gakai, OnLive, Facebook, Google, Yahoo. I mean, it's just amazing what you've done.
Yeah. Well, I like to describe it as a path, because I think that's something that we can all relate to. We all walk some path, and we all walk, different paths. I think no two paths are going to be alike. Mine, I think, is just one that where I just followed my instinct. I followed what reasoning I could muster, and I made decisions that I thought were the right ones at the time. With varying results like anyone else. So, as I mentioned, I started as a co-op at Intel, where I was doing a lot of logic validation and a lot of the logic and timing side of the IC world. But, then I went to Cadence, where I did a lot of the physical chip work. So, a lot of the place and route and layout stuff. Then I worked at a company called Teradyne for a long time, and they made testers for silicon, packaged and wafer form. And that was also fascinating for me as a product, because a tester is like a $2 million product when it's fully outfitted. So I learned a lot about what it takes to support such a product and such a large physical product. So it's very reminiscent of like an electric car or something like that. At Yahoo, I learned a lot about culture and product as consumed by users as opposed to other enterprises. If you think about Intel, Cadence, and Teradyne, they make products that are consumed by other enterprises. So there's a lot of B2B sales, but at Yahoo it was very consumer facing, and I learned a lot of that. I learned a lot about infrastructure, a lot about SaaS, and a lot about a different kind of software altogether that isn't shrink-wrapped or packaged up. So that was interesting. At Google, I learned a lot about scale and innovation, how they cultivate culture and how important it is to talent retention, how to scale from big to inconceivably big, how to have software as infrastructure. I think those are some of the lessons that anyone can learn at Google. Facebook was very much about startup problems and startup culture and starting from something that's very small and growing it, but also because the organization is small, you have such access to all these different initiatives within the company. So I really learned a lot about, again, product growth, how to grow product, how to have market fit, how to scale from very small to very big, how to have company-wide impact as an individual contributor and in some cases technology leader, how to fail fast, how to perform really fast, but at the same time, thoughtful iteration. And I think that's one of the key lessons for a startup is you have to always iterate, and that's one of the key advantages that you have over a large organization. At OnLive, I learned what it's like to be in a startup that was in stealth mode and incubated for years and years before even releasing a product. Now, I was only there for 4 months, and ultimately I decided to leave. The company ended up not making it, but I certainly learned a lot of lessons there as well, even though it was a short stay. And at Gaikai, I think, it was a great opportunity to see a startup from the very early all the way through to an early exit. So that's, a great opportunity to see how a company gets sold. And, I was an early stage executive there and scaling and managing. And even after it was acquired, I stayed for 2 years, and we built a much larger infrastructure for streaming and worked a lot on metrics, data, raising money, the venture world to some degree. So those are all, lessons that I acquired at the respective places and in the path that I walked. And I hope your audience finds some of those things helpful and can kind of provide context for themselves about what they can pick up wherever they are right now.
It's, again, it's sort of fascinating, all the different sort of experiences that you've had in your career and the pieces of experiences that have added to your ability to, drive success. So it's just very, very interesting. You must find then, and you're a founder yourself, and you see founders with the startups that you're supporting with the venture funds, and then also with these really famous, companies that you worked with. Do you see any sort of things in common that makes, for founder success?
Well, gosh, that's a very hard thing to nail down to just a couple of, it's kind of a very open field, right? It's a very, depending on how you think about things, there are different lessons that you can take away. I think if you have entrepreneurship in you, you probably know that. And if you, as you go through the chapters of your life, if you take time to take stock about what have I learned here, is it time to move on or not, I think there's no wrong lesson. There's no kind of way to do, as long as you're being productive and you're creating value, I think there's no way to do it wrong. So one of the things that I would look for as a common thread is, am I creating value? And if you know how to create value inside of an organization or by yourself, an organization of any size, from organization of one to an organization of thousands, then I think that's a common trait. I think that's a trait for success. If you are have that indomitable spirit, if you, in a sense, have the tenacity to find the solution when you can't find the solution, right? So much of discovering new things is just being faced with a wall and having no choice but to innovate your way around that wall and having the tenacity to just keep trying. And at the same time, when you know that you've tried enough, when you have enough evidence to know that either it's working or enough evidence to know that it's not going to work. And I think if you have the skill set to know that, that also translates pretty universally. So I think there's a lot of traits that are, you know, that translate across different situations. You know, and it doesn't, you don't have to be an entrepreneur. You don't have to necessarily be an individual contributor your entire life to be. I don't think those things necessarily cast you in a situation where you're not able to create value or you're not able to innovate. I think you can always do those things.
Now, hopefully I'm not getting this wrong, but it seems to me I just saw an article from the CEO of AngelList and a really successful serial entrepreneur, quite famous in Silicon Valley. And so I want to put that caveat, this is sort of going from memory, but he said that the attributes he looks for is things like intelligence, I think he said energy, integrity, and charm. So an interesting list.
Mm-hmm. That is an eclectic list. Yeah, I think there's a lot of I think there's a lot of there that resonates with me. Though I've certainly worked with folks who have been able to create value, but haven't necessarily been charming. And I think there's always a place for someone in an organization, provided that they have the right leadership. Now, in his case, his leadership style may require that people be gracious or socially capable. But you know, it all depends on you as a leader and you as a culture. He's essentially spelling out his culture. Culture is one of these things where you can't really do it wrong, but what you should do is do it strongly. Culture should be something that in a way is polarizing because, when your culture is very strong, when somebody new shows up, they immediately read the culture, and they say, oh my gosh, this is where I belong. I've been looking for a company like this my whole life. Or they'll say, wow, this is not for me. I'm definitely not going to go into this company. And that's kind of what you want. You want that decision to be made up front, and you want those who feel at home to join you, and you want those who are not going to function well in your culture to say, this is not for me. Self-selection in a way.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Robin. I actually see all of those traits in you. You're obviously intelligent. You definitely have energy. You probably have the highest integrity of a person I've ever met. And on the charm side, his sort of take on that was when he works with a founder, he wants to make sure that there isn't a personality clash or, you know, this is somebody that, because he's going to spend a lot of time with that person. And he describes it this way. He says, look, I'm going to spend a lot of time with him. It's going to be a journey. It could be 5 or 10 years. I want to make sure that I can work with the guy or with the lady. And I think that's you too, right? So I think you have that as well, right?
Well, that's a very good point. You know, I think the open communication and the transparency and the integrity are super critical. But I think if you are always yourself and you have some rough edges, I think people learn how to work with that. I think, you know, not to be cliche, but or to overuse a trope, but, you know, a lot of people obviously say that Steve Jobs is a difficult person to work with. Yet I think there are people in the world who worked with him just fine. So I think it's all about your personality. I think I've worked with some incredibly difficult people, but still found a way to have a relationship and be successful with them and work together. So I think I completely appreciate where he's coming from, and it really is about how you define your individual culture with your founders as an investor and how you want to relate with them. Because I agree, it's a long road. Most founders, I think with investors, it's going to be a lifetime relationship or at a minimum 10 years because it takes that long to do something, you know, super, super meaningful. I mean, there are certainly stratospheric growth companies like Facebook, but even they took 8 years, you know, to IPO from 2004 to 2012 when they IPO'd. So, you know, you do work together for a long time. It's absolutely true.
Yeah, and you see this O2O, so this online-offline revolution and companies like Uber and those guys. I'm just so surprised that the valuation is just through the roof. These unicorns, they call them, right?
Right, right. Yeah, the valuations is an interesting thing to witness. You know, I have a kind of my own read on that. I think the market dynamics are really what are causing these things, and there is a lot happening that I think pushes them in that direction of high valuations and raising cash while you can. You know, there are certain capital flows that have been going in one direction for a long time because of Fed policy, monetary policy. You know, people whose money would have been just fine in a CD or a savings account suddenly feel that they need to put it to work to stay ahead of inflation, that, you know, that magical 2 to 3%. And so they put that money to work in equities, and people who are, or fixed income or bonds, and people who were in fixed income and bonds feel the need to go to large caps, and the people who were in large caps that are chasing that larger return feel they need to go to mid caps, and the mid cap players want to go to the small caps, and then people want to go into the venture markets, and so of course, you know, when you go into the venture market, the more conservative players, institutional players, want to go into the later stages because you can track IRR and you get a return over 2 to 3 years in a Series D or a Series C, Series B, then going to an IPO or some exit. But then the people who were happy with the late-stage venture, now they crave more risk and more return, and they go to kind of mid-stage and earlier stage Series B, Series A type territory. And so there's a whole flow of capital that's been happening, and I think the unicorns have wisely taken advantage of the available capital and absorbed it all and got while the getting was good. But I think over time we'll see kind of these things, you know, normalize and revert to the mean. It, you know, it'll take a year or 2 years, whatever it is. But I think there's a lot of that's happening that's very macro-driven.
Now, earlier we talked about an MVP. So what are the stages in developing a minimum viable product, that is an MVP, and knowing what features to include?
Sure, absolutely. An MVP is, as we talked about, something that has to be has to create value for the user, for the customer. So in the beginning, let's use maybe a poor analogy here, but maybe the restaurant analogy. In the beginning, you may be able to only you have limited resources, right? And I really like, I think it's Sam Altman has said in the past, he's the YC guy, has said in the past, he's kind of described it as a like conservation of love law, which I really like, which basically says that, look, as a startup, you have limited resources. So you can build a product that a lot of people kind of love or kind of find useful or maybe use once in a while. So maybe like an RSS aggregator or something like this, that just very simple RSS aggregation. And, you know, those aren't around anymore except for in use in podcasts. But or you can build something that a few people love a whole lot and cannot live without. So because if you could create something that a lot of people love a whole lot, then companies with deeper pockets would be chasing it, right? And so, you know, if you could build an iPhone, which a lot of people love a lot, you would do that. It's just very resource intensive, right? If you could build a search engine that indexes the entire internet and gives you results in seconds that a lot of people would love a lot, you would, you know, somebody's kind of already doing that. Someone with deep pockets and who's been at it for a while, kind of created the market, is already doing that. So as a startup, a lot of the advice is you try to find a niche that brings value, you know, creates a lot of love for some people. So the way to think about this is maybe if you have limited resources, first you start out maybe with a small stand at a county fair, and you make one thing. Let's say you make delicious short rib. So you just make short rib and you sell that and that works, and you refine it, you get the flavors right, you get people to come back, the ones that come back, and you ask them, hey, what did you like about the short rib? What was your favorite part? What did you enjoy the most? What did you not enjoy? Oh, there's too many fat chunks. Okay, I'll make it, you know, I'll chop it off. Oh, but you enjoy the flavor. Maybe I'll use oxtail to make it richer. So you start to refine this product, but you're making a very simple product. Your next step, and you see that you're creating value, your next step might be to say, well, maybe I can get a food truck with the resources that I've, I built this kind of small revenue platform selling at the fair. Maybe now I can afford to take a risk and put together a food truck, and maybe I'll sell oxtail soup and oxtail sandwiches, and that way I'll have soup and sandwiches. Now I'm kind of diversifying and creating more value with the core thing that I've learned. And so you go on like this until you're able to open a restaurant, maybe have 10 dishes, and even in the restaurant world today, when you see people trying to control cost but create great value, you'll often look at a menu and you'll find maybe 5-8 entrees that are just done really well. And it's not like going to the Cheesecake Factory and having 100 dishes. It's the art of startup is really doing a few things really, really well and really, really thoughtfully. And ultimately, the litmus test there is, does it create value? Does it create a delight for the person consuming it? And do they come back over and over? And do they feel sad or angry when they can't have what you're making?
And I'm just struck by how useful the information is that you're giving, not just to startups, but anybody. Even in terms of your relationships or friends or going to school or a large enterprise, it's all about value. Make sure that there's value delivery, right? So,
absolutely. And, disruption theory is all about actually dissecting the value chain and why it's difficult to innovate and disrupt because of the value chain. So it really does come down to creating value. And whether you're investing or creating or running a restaurant, it really comes down to that.
We've talked about this earlier. You talked about product market fit, and of course, prior to that, there's something called problem solution fit. So for startups, what is problem solution fit? And then can you describe how this matures to the stages of product market fit?
Sure. So I really like to think about this this kind of the set of problems that startups face as in the early stage, defining the problem correctly. I think so much of getting innovation right and creating value is about defining the right problem. If you can actually define a real problem and you can define it with all its all the nuances that it merits, then I think you're halfway to creating an answer. So much of it is really defining what is the actual problem. We've had startups that have defined the problem in the wrong way and hence built the wrong solution for it. In some cases, built very elegant and technical and robust wrong solutions. And this is the problem that existed. It was actually, it still happens today, but with so much in the startup ecosystem, even without knowing why and understanding the technicals, the founders today are really diligent and they really research a lot and they take advice from investors. And so they really focus on that narrow niche and they really try things and they really validate the premises. Even though they're maybe running through some mechanical and they may not understand it their first time around, they're very good at kind of doing the right things for their startup and very diligent in that way. But I think if you harken back, if you go back a little bit further in history, if you go back to the early 2000s, late 90s, we had a lot of products that were very feature-rich. Somebody would get funded $2 million, they'd go out and build this amazing piece of software, lots of features, they super robust, very mature, doesn't crash, they put it out in the marketplace, and nobody uses it. Or if they use it, they use one-third of the features and the rest is wasted effort. So I think defining the problem and iterating through a problem and making sure that you've really captured the problem well is super important to getting to that right answer and providing something that your users or consumers will find value in, because then you're solving a real problem for them and you kind of measured your way to what that problem was rather than assuming it. Because I like to say that everyone in this who's got an entrepreneurial spirit, anyone who likes to innovate or invent, I think we're all really great at having this intuition, right? Like I think I know what the market wants. I know what would be good if I created this. And so we've got this great intuition, and I think intuition is really great for vision. And I think intelligence is really good for strategy. But I think good data is what builds good product. And so that data is what helps you define the problem and helps you define the answer to that problem. And that later translates into product market fit, which we can also talk about if you like.
Sure, absolutely. Can you get into that right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So product market fit then becomes a situation where through data, through the acquisition of good data, you get to a situation where you're able to measure what the market wants, where the demand for what you're making sometimes feels overwhelming. That is what product market fit feels like. But I think a lot of folks say, well, you know, I've got this free product, and I've got 1,000 people using it, and, you know, then I applied some growth, and now I've got 50,000 people using it. I think I've got a pretty good product market fit. I should go out and get some money. So you go out and get the money, and then you change one thing. Maybe you start charging 5 cents. Maybe you start charging $10 a month, and suddenly everything goes away. And so what you thought was product market fit was not product market fit. Because the way to think about product market fit is that it's not like a degree, right? It's not like once you achieve it, it's yours forever. So if I go out and get a PhD right now, I'll be Dr. Pimentel the rest of my life. But if I go out and build a startup and get product market fit, if I perceive that I've gotten product market fit, I could very well lose it the next day if I don't know what my changes, what the repercussions are from my changes and from what I'm doing day to day. And you can really only know those things if you measure your way there. If you're measuring retention and you're measuring engagement every day and you're watching these micro changes, you're running good experiments, you know what your product lives and breathes by, what it needs to fuel it. If you know through data what fuels your growth, then product market fit is something that you understand inside and out, and you know that there are certain things you can't touch, and you'll know that you either have it or you don't, because you can see its changes as you make changes. And the most important part, I think, to product market fit, which often gets left out in many conversations, I feel anyway, is that you can really only know if you have product market fit if you know what the cost is of that product. So to give you an example, a lot of folks, now let's use the iPhone again, a lot of folks love the iPhone. It has a very precise product market fit. It's a specific product with a specific set of features, a form factor, specific size screen, specific battery life. But people are willing to pay $650 for it. If I change that price tomorrow to $1,000, the iPhone will have very different product market fit. It will manifest very differently in the market. And if I change the price to, let's say, $150, it'll have very different market fit there again from the $650 it has today. It may become more ubiquitous. That may be a result, yes. But you may also get a different user base. You may get people who are, you know, more of a commodity player, discount chaser, as opposed to someone who really values the refinement in it. So that's a very precise product market fit. And because you know the cost, you know that when you change the price, that you're going to change the dynamics of what it means to have product market fit. And, you know, there are lots of examples of this. So, you know, someone may say, well, what's the cost of using Facebook? Presumably they have great product market fit. And I would say, well, you know, Facebook actually measured their cost, their product market fit, throughout their entire life of the product. So a cost of using Facebook is actually the time I spend on it, right? It's the access to my information that I'm giving Facebook. These are all costs, right? And you can think of it as maybe points of friction. They're things that I'm giving up to use the product. I have to look at ads when I'm on Facebook. So that is a cost as well. And Facebook was always fine-tuning where the ads were, how in your face, were they in the feed, were they off to the side. You know, were they really flashy? Did they have to be subdued? Did they have to be very image-driven? Can they have a lot of text in them, or do they limit the text? There's a very precise measurement of what happens when you change these things, all these attributes, all these features, and what it costs the user. And when you change that cost value, cost and value are always on this scale. Think of the scales of justice. But on one side, you have value, perception of value, and on the other side, you have cost, perception of cost. And when those things are in balance through measurement, through good data, then you're going to have good product market fit.
And that's just a great discussion about this continuing sort of series of making iterations, but also getting feedback based on data and making decisions based on data, and also trying to anticipate or anticipating unintended consequences and sort of thinking through all of the steps. It's just a remarkable process. And you've done it so many times. You've done it so successfully. So you're giving some really great advice to the audience.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately the thing that I think is important is to understand that if you achieve something through a measurement, that's going to have a much more solid foundation, and you can really start to make experiments that are useful in terms of being able to predict the outcome, and then with data being able to either negate or confirm, so either corroborate or discount your assumption, your premise for the experiment, and then I think you can really start to make tweaks that are meaningful, and you can measure your way to even that aha moment. Every good product has a moment where the user feels, I get this, I know how to do this. And using a great product should feel that way. You know, if you make the wrong promise about a product, it's not going to feel as good as if you make the right promise and then that promise gets fulfilled.
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me of Steve Blank in his books. He's always stressing this idea of don't be afraid to go out and ask questions and try to get that validation. Everything you do, go out there, and get out of your office and talk to people.
Yeah, be wrong. In the early stages, the one advantage you have over a large organization is the ability to be wrong and have the cost be less, but yet you get the upside of that learning. So, just don't be afraid to hear when you're wrong in the beginning. You should embrace that. That's the more times you do that in the beginning, the cheaper that iteration is. To be wrong later on is a much more costly iteration. Iterating through a market, through a promise that you make through a user, it's a lot cheaper than iterating through product. Product takes people and it takes money, and pivoting a product is a lot harder than pivoting an experiment or a market promise or copy or an advertisement. So don't be afraid to be wrong in the beginning.
Now, my next question, because you have such a great success history, and Robin, you eat up and you consume so much of what's out there in terms of informing what you do, I know that you're a great person to ask this question. And as for startups, do you have recommended resources like books, people, websites, and so on that they can study? And you talked about some of the people already, like Ben Horowitz, Peter Thiel, Clayton Christensen, and others, but are there other things that you want to add to that list?
Yeah, sure. So let's see. Definitely, I think the books are a great thing to, and you know, there's a lot of blogs and things like that that I think people can learn from. If I had to say something, if I had to kind of give you an order, right, or an ordering, an ordered set. About kind of what to focus on. What I would say is, as an entrepreneur, as an inventor, study your users first, because I think that's the best place to learn the most that you can. Ultimately, what an investor is counting on is that you're an expert in your product. So that's really important. So study whatever field you're in, whatever craft you have. Make sure you understand that technology, but also understand your users, understand who you're going after. Then study your metrics, study what those people are telling you, study what the lessons are that you're picking up from your market as you develop this product. And those things will help you build the product, and that's really the most important thing. But then there are other resources, of course, like learning how to run a startup, learning how to recruit, learning how to educate a team, learning how to build a strong culture. And for that, I you know, the books that you mentioned are certainly the right place to go. 500 Startups recently released, I think, some early-stage marketing videos that are useful. I think if you look at the Y Combinator series, I think How to Start a Startup, which I think they did in collaboration with Stanford, if I'm not mistaken. If you kind of go through that series, you learn a lot about how to build a really good product, and I think that's ultimately the most important thing in startups. The rest, I think you can pick up.
And I guess I want to add another item, and that is listen to this podcast with Robin.
Okay, fair enough.
You know why? Because there's some really useful tips here. So, and just throughout, you ooze tips, great lessons. So, now you're a successful entrepreneur. What are your top lessons for success? Now, you've mentioned some of them, but do you want to sort of quantify it again or summarize?
Yeah, sure. Well, I would say one of the earliest lessons I picked up was, being afraid to fail in some sense. I think that was something that I was very much guilty of early in my career. And I felt like, you know, any failure was, a bad thing. And I think I would definitely urge people to not be afraid to fail, but to in fact to embrace failure and do it as quickly and take away that lesson as quickly as you can. I think a lot of entrepreneurs I've seen try to shortcut their way around experience because that's what failure is, right? You're building experience. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs I've run into when they run afoul, it's because they're trying to kind of find a shortcut around failure. And so they tend to be reserved with ideas. They'll talk to an investor and say, well, I can't tell you what I'm building, because somebody will steal my idea. This idea, I think someone described to me that they were watching the Silicon Valley series on HBO. Someone described this thing that happened to them called brain rape. So this is where somebody takes all your ideas. And honestly, I think, you know, ideas are, for me, a much smaller part of the equation. It's really execution that defines and creates value. So don't be afraid to fail. Don't be afraid. Somebody takes your idea. That's fine. Don't worry about it. In fact, some of the best ideas are very crowded. There were, more than 10 search engines when Google came along, but they executed so well that, you know, they basically took the search engine market from zero to one, as Peter Thiel puts it in his book. If you look at Facebook, they were like the sixth, seventh social network. Friendster, MySpace, all these guys were around, but they just executed so much better that they created something that's immensely valuable to not just to its shareholders but to the world. So don't be afraid to have failure, and don't be afraid to put your ideas out there because your ideas are kind of like beacons. I think others will be attracted to them, and it'll all be about how you execute. So just that would be my advice: is just execute.
Yeah, I guess execution is key. And in fact, I was asked to write an introduction to a book just this past week, and it's going to go out to young professionals and college students. And one of the things I indicated in the book is people get into what I call perfection paralysis, mm-hmm. or taking too much time. And yeah, I think that's such great advice. Go and try, see what happens, right?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that Facebook did really well early on. One of the lessons I took away is just iterate quickly. You know, you get to perfection through iteration, and there's no shortcut around that. There's no shortcut around failure.
You know, there's a study.
I completely agree.
There's a study out of Harvard and Brigham Young, and they talk about I think they call it the DNA platform, and They have five qualities that make for disruption or disruptive innovators, and that's questioning, observing, experimenting, associating, and networking. So on the questioning side, it's all about always be curious. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to answer questions. I mean, you know, just, and then there's the observing. Observe everybody around you. Observe your, and you talked about this. Observe your clients, your customers, your end users. Watch them. Ask them questions. So that's the observing part. And then experimenting. And you just talked about this too. Try. Don't be afraid of failure. Keep trying. Experiment. Give it a shot. See what happens. Get feedback. And absolutely. And then they talk about associating. That is, in fact, I read another study this week where they said over 50% of a key to success is having an open, diverse network versus a closed network, meaning associate with many diverse and interesting areas and people as you can, because you're going to pick up ideas and be able to see those ideas. So that's the association part. Associate, take diverse pieces of information, integrate them, and that'll help you in disruption. The last part is networking. That is forming relationships with different people all over the place and talk to them and get to know them. And because everybody has interesting ideas. So that's the question, observing, experimenting, associating, and networking. And you're touching on these items as you're answering the question. I think it's just amazing that you're backing this, you know, this research was conducted over 6 years with thousands of individuals and companies and 25 of the most disruptive, most interesting, successful people in history. So
I think it's a wonderful framework, as you described it, and as the research they put together. I think it's absolutely a great way to structure your thought process and your actions. I think the way that I think about it is, what is the, because so many people, you know, they're ultimately as entrepreneurs, we're people, and so this wonderful framework, I think anybody who adopts it without any reserve, without any fear, we'll do really great. But I think as people, we have these fears, we have these reservations, these points of hesitation. And so I really like to dissect, what is it, the thing that causes someone to have inaction? What is it that causes someone to not share their ideas and not associate? So if you can address the fear, the causes, and you can disarm those, then I think you can live, you can execute closer to the framework. And that's a lot of what you know, we do at K5 is try to really focus on that psychology of innovation to try to get to those, in a sense, ideals or best practices as humans, right, with the path that we've walked with all the things that have gone wrong and all the things that have gone right and why we do the things we do. So I think the research is spot on.
Now, Robin, you've got this career which has spanned. In fact, it's your pedigree is like one of the best I've ever seen. You know,
oh, not at all.
Well, I don't know. I was with the companies you work for. Come on, right? And how you contributed to their success. So, because of the things you've done, are there any stories of impossible challenges that you came across where it just, oh my God, this is just a huge hurdle, and yet you were able to master them?
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, I'll say, obviously, you know, as I mentioned, the path is one that's not too inorganic. So in other words, there weren't any serendipitous things necessarily. It was really just a matter of, you know, so for example, at Intel, I was a co-op, you know, that was my role there. At Yahoo, I was just an engineer. I happened to be an engineer that, took on a challenge of integrating, helping to integrate a recently acquired startup and their infrastructure in particular. And I just said, well, you know, I want to work on the big problems, but if the big problem right now is integrating this small startup's infrastructure, I'm happy to help be part of that team and tackle that. So I think just if you're creating value, don't worry about the scope of the problem or the visibility or the politics of it. Just create value. And I think you'll get some lessons out of it. And don't be afraid to fail. Don't be afraid of challenges. Don't be afraid to be wrong and iterate. And, you know, those are really, I think, the keys to success. Those are the top lessons that I would give someone. And I think, you know, I'll also take a cue here. I think if I were to really kind of zero throw in, you know, if you're a manager or director, an executive at a technology company, big or small, and I had to share something with you, I would actually borrow a page from Ben Horowitz's blogs, and then later on, you know, I was reading his blogs for a long time, but then he released his book, I think, in 2013 or 14, somewhere around there, and he put a lot of this in his book. But I think as a manager, a technical leader, any kind of leadership position, one really important thing is to not disregard or take for granted the onboarding of your of staff and of new engineers. I think education is so important for having a really good, effective team and good, effective execution. When you take the time to really teach people the culture, teach people the way decisions get made, teach people what's important about the product, where compromises can be made and where compromises cannot be made. I think when you really onboard people well, you're building an organization that's going to last. So if I had to say, if I had to point out kind of one insurmountable task, I would say that in the beginning it seems like building an organization from zero, from one person to building an organization that has 20, 30, 50, 100,000 people in it seems insurmountable from you know, if you're doing it from the very, very beginning. And I think for me that was one of the things that I experienced is, well, how do I go from being you know, a technical leader to being a director, an executive? You know, these things seem insurmountable, but I think if you onboard your people well, and if you educate them well, and you really take time to focus on their development and really working with them, having productive one-on-ones, then I think it is possible to build a really effective org from nothing. And I have to say that seemed impossible in the beginning. And you know, I've also seen kind of been a witness to some impossible tasks that I've been involved with as a team member. So not as an individual, but you know, Gaikai taking a product, taking something that streams, gets rendered in a data center, but then runs on a mobile phone, on a tablet, on a TV, and you know, everyone said it was impossible. The latency is too great. You can't do that. And yet we found through data, through experimentation, through measurement, that we could do it. You know, I'll give you just a quick example. If you look at the latency through a TV because of all the image processing, you may have a PlayStation 4 plugged into it, but all the processing in that TV could add up to 50, 60, in some cases we found 90 milliseconds through a TV. So what you think is local can actually have you know, significant latency. Now, to give you a sense of scale, I can, with a good fiber infrastructure, in good you know, DWDM technology, I can go from the East Coast, from the West Coast to the East Coast and back round trip time in 50 milliseconds. So, if you think about some TVs have double that latency in the image processing. Well, I could, if I get rid of that, I could render a game on the East Coast and you could play it on the West Coast, and you might not psychologically be able to tell. You know, if you're really fine-tuned, you might be able to tell. But a lot of folks just, you know, depending on the game, if it's like a platformer or something like this, you wouldn't be able to tell. So it's only through measurement that I think you can make the impossible, you know, possible, or you can either say that it can work, or you can have enough evidence to know for sure that it will not work, rather than speculate. So what seems impossible could be impossible, but you don't know until you kind of run through it and you measure your way to that conclusion.
You know, so then from your answer to the last question, then can you summarize some of the important lessons?
Yeah, I mean it's kind of the way I summarize it in the last question was really that it's, I think, by executing, by just doing what needs to be done, you can get to impossibilities and innovate your way there. I mean, gosh, think about Moore's Law. When he said it, it seemed completely impossible, right? Yet it's still holding up. We're still finding ways to innovate. And, you know, now we're really focused on power consumption, and it's less about clock speed and things like that, and it's more about being able to put more transistors and having you know, more parallel computing type of structure where you have a lot of on-chip networks enabling this parallelization, but then you have to make them cost-efficient or power-efficient because there are so many more components in there. So I would say these things were possible because these pivots were possible because we measured our way there, because we did what needed to be done, and then we took stock of what we did in a very accurate and refined way, and then we iterated again and iterated again. So I think that's how you keep momentum. You just do things. You continue iterating. You're not afraid to fail, and you measure all along the way.
You know, earlier this week, I had a chat with Pedro Domingos at the University of Washington. In fact, he just won the highest prize at the largest AI conference, where him and his team have developed, they call it RITIS. It's a machine learning optimization, or it's an optimization technique. And its improvement factor is, what is it? I think it's 100,000 minimum to up to 10 billion. So it's a radical new kind of way of doing something, and he talks about the reason that there's magic. In fact, his technique has been called magic. He said the reason that there's magic in it is because when they seem to have an insurmountable continuous problem, what you do is you break it down into little manageable steps, and you solve those manageable steps, and that's how you solve the bigger problem. And it's like when you have a major challenge and you think, oh, my God, it's just so big. How do I handle it? Well, you use data. You break it down into manageable steps. And if you iterate in those manageable steps, you'll solve the bigger problem.
I love that. I absolutely love that. I think it's so true. I'm not familiar with the research, but the method and the methodology definitely resonates with me.
Now, you're a senior executive, very, very successful, and now entrepreneur and, a general partner and so on with these different funds, and you've been trying to mentor startups and so on. You've got a great perspective in terms of what creates great leadership or great management. Can you share some of those?
Yeah, I think, and we talked about some of them earlier. I think, you know, great management comes from building great teams. I really define myself as an executive by how well my team is executing and the product of that execution. So I think training is really important. I think having, again, meaningful one-on-ones. We're in a situation where it's about the employee in that one-on-one and not about projects. It's not about the organizational goals in that situation. It's really about the employee and removing their obstacles, empowering them, making sure they're getting the education and the answers they need. And I think it's also about communication. I love organizations where anybody can email the CEO with a problem. And, you know, of course you get these off-the-wall things. Because, you know, people who say, oh, I can email the CEO that are already kind of off the beaten path, they're just going to do what they do. But, you know, more often than not, that the people who normally wouldn't email anybody, wouldn't bother anyone, but really see something wrong, they have a recourse. And I love this concept of having recourse. I think it's also true in product in a way, right? If you're using a product and something's going wrong and you don't have a way to get help, it's really frustrating as a user experience. And I think as a team member, as someone in an org, if you can't have access to leadership, if you don't have recourse, I think it can be very frustrating and demoralizing. I think some other leadership things are, you mentioned success, but I think, you know, if you want to polarize cynicism all the way to its logical end, you would say success is what happens after you failed in every possible way. But what that implies is that you haven't given up, right? Because it's what happened at the end, which implies you were still trying. But the non-cynical view of that is that you measure all along the way, and yeah, you fail, but you understand why you failed, and presumably you won't fail in that way again, and you So each new failure teaches you something new. And I think that's a lot of what you have to kind of encourage as a leader is encourage people to fail in new ways and not be afraid of failure. At Facebook, you know, they used to say, you know, run fast and break things, move fast and break things was the organizational mantra. And it was very true. Now, you know, the cynics would say, you know, yeah, move fast and move fast with scissors in your hand and trip over stuff and poke yourself in the eye. But you can't argue with the results of the organization, which were that, you know, they actually developed a culture where it was okay to do things and it's okay to take risks. And all you have to do is really then manage risk, which I think is the best outcome you can have. And that led to a very robust AD experimentation platform, which led to a very robust multivariate testing platform, which led to kind of this thing that you hear very famously about Facebook and the way that they can push out features to individual users. So, you know, you can have an engineer and a product person work on some new feature and push it out to one user in St. Louis that has 10 friends and see how it works for them, see how it manifests. So they have this incredible way to be able to experiment but contain the scope of the failure, and which then ended up building this great experimentation platform so that engineers can push to production. You're just limiting the scope of what that push can do in production.
I just love these stories that you give because it so resonates. Now, we're going to change direction a little bit and get maybe into broader questions, and one of which is okay. About computing. You know, computing as a recognized profession, maybe on par with some of the other professions out there with demonstrated professional development, adherence to the code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, perhaps recognized credentials. Do you think that that should happen, computing in general?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. I think that we use our talents to provide a service. And I think if you look at medical professionals providing a service, you want a certain quality of service, right? You want them to have an oath to do no harm and to try to heal you. And so I think, you know, in the technology world, any time that the talent someone has for technology is used as a way to provide a service, that you absolutely need a way to, you know, recognize those that are doing it well and have a way for those that are not doing it well to measure themselves and say, oh, I'm not doing it well. I should get better at this and I should get better at that. So I absolutely think that we should go in that direction with technology, specifically with kind of talent as a service.
You have many interests. Do you wish to talk further about them, or you want to keep them private?
Oh no, I mean, I you know, my interests really are very typical to what your listeners and then if they get transcribed, your readers might have. It's, you know, I'm really interested in technology. I love silicon. I love software. I love hardware. I have a friend and partner who is in robotics, and I've learned a lot from him. And I love robotics. Outside of tech, I love to ride a motorcycle around the track. I think it's just the best environment to ride a motorcycle as opposed to on the street. You know, on a track, everyone's going in the same direction. You don't have to share the road with cars. It's just motorcycles. There are no traffic lights. You know, if you make a mistake, you have runoff room. You don't fall off a cliff. If you do make a mistake, you're typically in full leathers, so you can absorb the impact, you know, fairly well and come out with maybe just a few scratches. You know, you're very well protected in your helmet and your gear, and you can go so much faster than you could on the road. So I enjoy that. I think it's a great way to you know, have excitement in your life and get thrills. And I think that's what everyone should strive for, is a good balance of kind of the professional life and you know, then family and the exhilarating life. And if what exhilarates you is travel, then you should travel. If what exhilarates you is hang gliding, then, you know, do it safely for goodness sake, but, you know, do what thrills you.
You know, you do travel, and your work takes you to many diverse areas. When you talk, you have an opportunity to meet some really interesting people. Do you have any stories that you can share? Maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
Oh gosh, yeah, absolutely. So I guess I'm a geek at heart. So what I'll say is, I think everyone should see a Carrier hotel. So, you know, if you don't know what a Carrier hotel is, it's essentially these buildings. And, you know, in some metros, there's only that one building, but in larger metros, there are multiple buildings that are Carrier hotels, or places where networks exchange data with each other and essentially build the intersection of points, the topology of the logical topology, the connected topology of the internet, and where networks kind of exchange traffic. And, you know, it's so funny to see some of the legacy ones, like, you know, One Wilshire and 350 Cermak in Chicago. Even some of the newer ones, like the Westin in Seattle. There's so much to see there, and it reminds me, there, you know, like so many. And I'm sure you guys have seen these like comical pictures of these hairball cable entanglements and crazy situations. But I think just from trying to understand the physical side of the net, it's such a cool thing to see, and it reminds you that change comes so fast. You know, I still remember vampire taps and thick net transceivers, and you know, for me, those early days of seeing that kind of infrastructure and you know what it is now with you know, DWDM and erbium doped fiber amplifiers and you know, muxes and, you know, crazy multi-lane transceivers, and things change so fast. I think it's just humbling to see kind of that infrastructure. And through my travels, I would say, because so much was around infrastructure, when you say, tell me something about your travel, like somehow you know, my mind goes to go see these wonderful Carrier hotels as you can.
Yeah, just fascinating again. You definitely have a technology bent.
Yeah, it's hard to apologize for it. I guess it's just the way you know, my path has taken me.
Now, we're down to our last question, and it's really, really free form.
Okay. Sure.
If you had the opportunity to discuss any broader questions or challenges, what would they mm-hmm. be, and how could they be solved?
So you mean as challenges for society, for technology in general?
Yeah, absolutely. Free form. Anything, you know.
However I interpret the question. Sure, okay.
Exactly.
That's wonderful. I'll definitely take some liberties then. You know, I'd say one of my favorite problems in the atoms is energy, and in particular energy storage, or maybe the equivalent of energy, good energy storage would be maybe compact energy generation. I think it's a key enabler for robotics and for society. You know, imagine a Segway that whose battery lasted a year and you didn't have to worry about charging it. I mean, could you lay down these very long paths and just, you know, leisurely go on your Segway instead of a car? Would that really change society? Or imagine a Tesla that could go for 1,000 miles and you didn't have to charge it so much. You know, how enabling would that be, and how much more cost efficient would that be from an infrastructure perspective? Really, really disruptive, I think. So I think, you know, energy generation, energy storage, and, you know, even think about, like, what would enable micro-robots or nano-robots. If you could really create you know, one way to continue doing what we're doing, which is to continue innovating on the mechanisms and the energy exchanges, and use friction gears and just continue to kind of innovate with the mechanics and the software and the electrical parts. But, you know, what if battery technology moved as fast as software? And it's hard, because, you know, this is the stuff that the universe is made of. This is hard physics. So it you know, by the universe that we live in, it can't be that fluid. But if But imagine if innovation moved really, really fast in energy generation and storage, what this world would look like. So I think those are that's a great problem to continue to not give up on, even though it's really, really, really hard. That's, I think, the physical world. I think if I were to kind of pick a problem in the software world, I really like problems in distributed computing as big challenges. So, multi-master state or database information replication, I think, is really fascinating. I think the best way, the thing that pops in my head, the easiest way to describe it is Brewster's or CAP theorem, where you can have consistency, availability, or partition tolerance to varying degrees. Like none of those buckets can be filled 100%. There's always a trade-off. It's almost like, pick two out of three. You can be consistent or available, but not partition tolerant and so on. I think that's one of the great problems in distributed computing and what I see as a software problem. And then maybe in the kind of human realm and the way we relate to each other, definitely, reforming, making Congress more effective is a big problem, right? I'd like to see that tackled. Lobbying, I'd love to see that addressed. I actually can imagine a world of the thought experiment where lobbying is illegal. Imagine if you couldn't pay to advocate, and you just had to use your voice and you were just, one of many voices, that had to be heard. So, a democracy not fueled by speech as money, I think, is an interesting one to conceptualize. I really enjoyed along this line of a book called The Gardens of Democracy, which I recommend for everyone, which encourages folks to think big but act small, act locally. So I definitely see that. I think having more autonomy locally and having more empowerment locally works really well. Today our firemen are managed at the county level, not at the national level. I think there's a lot of innovation there that can happen, but I definitely see the U.S. political system as a barrier. And, if you want to look at kind of societal problems, I think, that may be one that's worthwhile.
Well, Robin, you've given us some great ideas to chew on here. for the next decade.
Can software change politics? There's a lot of people trying to do that.
I know that you've got a hard stop, and you're a busy professional. You're in high demand. You just got an amazing talent to communicate and to innovate. So I really want to thank you for coming in today and sharing so much of your wisdom and experiences with our audience.
It's an honor, Stephen. Thank you for having me. I know how great your audience is, how educated and technical they are. I know all the organizations that you're tapped into, and I feel very grateful to be able to share my observations with your audience, and I'm humbled by the outreach. So it's absolutely been my pleasure.
Well, thank you again, and I want to close by saying I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Robin Pimentel, international engineer, technology executive, entrepreneur, and investor.